My first teaching job was a teaching assistant at a Presbyterian seminary where everyone was required, all the Presbyterians were required to teach, to take Hebrew. And now I teach at a seminary, United Methodist Seminary, where only people who want to be there take the class. And boy, is it different. If I never teach another student who doesn't want to be there again, that will be just fine with me. Start the tape, please. My name is Peter Nash. I teach at Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary in Hebrew and Old Testament, and I chair the department there in Biblical Studies. This is the 9th of 9 studies on the book of Samuel, and this is for those people, today is for those people who feel like they're working only for a paycheck, and sometimes that gets you down and doesn't feel like you're doing much of anything other than bringing home a paycheck and paying the bills and barely doing that. Because we're going to find out today that David did exactly the same thing. And, you know, David, the great poet, according to the Hebrew tradition, David, the ideal king, according to the Hebrew tradition, had a job that none of us would want, and he did it to save his life and to earn a paycheck, and that was he was a butcher. What he butchered was people and their livestock. That's often shocking to people, but it's true. It has to be true because it's in the Bible. Let's take a look. That last part was a joke. Let's take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 27. This occurs immediately after the second time David spares Saul's life. For those of you who've been here with us, just bear with me as I remind the other folks that from chapter 17 on, after David killed, or 18 on, after immediately after David had killed Goliath, and Saul realizes that David is competition for the throne, not only for his son Jonathan, who is to be his successor, but also to Saul himself. When David comes back from the battle with the Philistines, in which he kills Goliath, David gets top billing. Actually, he gets second billing, but it's the better billing, according to Hebrew poetry. And Saul's ticked off about that. And as Janet just asked about already in chapter 16, we hear that Saul had displeased God and an evil spirit from the Lord. The spirit of God left him, and an evil spirit from the Lord entered him. And so from chapter 18 to the end of the book, actually, but for 10 chapters now, David has been trying to avoid literally the spears of Saul, the traps of Saul, which included two of his daughters. And you have to read the story to know that that's not a sexist comment. And two of those occasions, David has had the opportunity to kill the king of Israel, but has held back his hand because David understands that if you strike out against the anointed of God, the anointed of Yahweh, it will mean no good for yourself. And in the story that we saw yesterday, we see David come to understand, ironically, when we see the stories today, ironically, that if you strike out against anyone in vengeance, you're going to be held liable or can potentially be held liable as for judgment from God or from their cousin, as this, things worked out in the ancient world, unlike today. And no one takes retaliation, certainly not governments. Enough of a setup. Again, this is immediately after David spares Saul's life the second time. If someone would read 27:1 through 4 for us, that would be helpful. Anyone at all?
I'll do it.
Thank you.
And David said in his heart, "I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." So David arose and went over, and he and 600 men who were with him, to Achish the son of Maach, king of Gath. And David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he sought for him no more.
Things are kind of cool. What is David at this point? The Israelites have been battling with the Philistines for several chapters now, about 10, 12 chapters now. So what does it say when David, this potential pretender to the throne, leaves the country and goes to Gath?
A turncoat.
He's a turncoat. He's in a state of treason. Probably not going to be any poems written about him, giving him top billing over the kingdom of Israel, one would think. That's how frightened David is. David, by the way, has been anointed and appointed twice in two different settings by Samuel the prophet. He's heard from the prophet's mouth that he is the anointed of God. Nevertheless, he's so frightened in this situation that he leaves the country. It's, 10 years ago would have been the same as going to the Soviet Union, protesting the war, and then having the audacity to run for president. Yeah. Glad somebody got it.
Really?
That's the position that David's in. And he's frightened for what's going on. He's frightened for his own life. In spite of the fact that immediately at the end of chapter 26, this is what we hear from Saul. Then Saul said to David, "Blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them." So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. And David just spared his life, and Saul blesses him. And then next thing we hear, he's still frightened enough to leave the country. And he does put himself in a really precarious, certainly political situation. And what does David say when he shows up? Are there any questions or comments about this? One of the things I'd like you to do, we're going to run through a lot of material today, so I'm not going to have you spend until the end if we have time in the small group. So if we do, I'd like you to think about times when you've been frightened for your life, for your job, for your future, what kind of refuge you sought and what other people might have thought about it. If it's made any difference, what other people thought about it, that is. Kind of refugee time. So, if someone would take just 5, 6, and 7, read that for us.
Then David said to Achish, "If I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?" So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of the days that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months.
Okay. So this is a fairly long exile here for David. He, and this city becomes part of the royal property of kings of Judah. We'll hear about it when we move into the book of Kings. I'll remind you that for this dispute that has been going on between the Philistines and the Israelites is over the borders of Judah and Philistia, down in the southwest of Israel. David, again, we see this formal language of request. David marches into the royal city, which is not quite what we think. It's not, Buckingham Palace or Washington, D.C. This is one of 5 cities that make up the Philistine Pentapolis, the Philistine Confederacy. But he still marches in and to the Lord there, calls himself a servant. "I'm not worthy to live in the royal city," and basically mooch off of you. "Do you have an outlying town where I could go and provide protection, as well as live off the land out there and not be such a burden to you? And, by the way, I would have some semblance of freedom myself." It's granted.
Is this good form to go in and make a request like this?
In this case, it's the only form that he has open to him. Mm-hmm. But certainly the linguistically, this is exactly the way we see it happen over and over again. Someone goes in with a request, calls him or herself a servant, In the case of Abigail, even though she was about to take five maids with her as she hopped on the donkey, that's like saying she packed her, her three maids and jumped in the back of the caddy and told the chauffeur to go. When it says she jumped on the donkey and took her five maids with her, it's the sort of the social equivalent. So this is a woman that continues to be a woman of sustenance. What she said was, your servant is ready to come. She will wash the feet of your servants. And she takes her five maids with her. This is the same kind of David, which is in his army. What we know, what we have seen in the previous chapters to be a substantial, well-trained, well-disciplined army, and what will prove itself in the next four or five verses to be an extremely competent army. He marches in and says, I'm your servant. I don't want to burden you, where can I go? Constantly putting oneself down as the form of speech for the request in Hebrew. Yes.
So, sorry, you may have covered this earlier. Philistines are doing this as much out of spite for Saul or for their own benefit, having 600 additional fighting men? Or?
We're going to see here, and just we haven't covered it, okay. It comes up, but there's a border war going on,
yeah.
And it's I know the Muslims say it, I don't think it's original with them, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah.
They've been fighting Saul for years. His champion is now coming over.
Sure, the, so the kid. He's doing it for spite to Saul or just to have.
Well, if the commandant of the Green Berets had decided to go over to North Vietnam.
Yeah.
We'd
welcome him.
Yeah, come on over, pal. Take the city. Which one do you want? It effectively neutralizes, as we'll see in the next paragraph, David. So they think. If someone would pick up 8 through the end of 8 through 12.
Now David and his men went up and made raids on the Geshurites and the Gerizzites and the Amalekites. But these were the landed settlements from Hillel on the way to Shur and on to the land of Egypt. David struck the land, leaving neither man nor woman alive, and took away the sheep, the ox, and the donkeys, camels, and the clothing, and came back to Achish. And when Achish asked, against whom have you made a raid today? David would say, against the Negeb of Judah, or against the Negeb of the Jerahmeelites, or against the Negeb of the Kenites. David left neither man nor woman alive to be brought back to Gath, thinking they might tell us and say, David has done so and so. Such was his practice all the time he lived in the country of the Philistines. Achish trusted David, thinking, he has made himself pretty abhorrent to his people Israel. Therefore, he shall be my servant.
Okay. My translation says, utterly abhorrent to his people. David here, to answer your question, has neutralized himself against the Philistines, so he thinks. The people of the three tribes that are listed there are the three areas, against the Negev, the south of Judah, the Negev of the Jerahmeelites, another southern section of Israel, clan of Israel, the Negev of the Kenites. These are relatives of Caleb, if you remember back to the Joshua, the conquest story of Israel. So David is going, what he's doing is making border raids on his own tribe, if in fact Bethlehem is part of Judah. At least one prominent historian, he was prominent only because he was my professor, believed that David was actually not a part of Judah, but according to the tradition, David is attacking his own tribe in Israel. And it's essential for him to wipe these people out. Because if there's a witness left that David is the one, then he has no stock left in Israel whatsoever. David has a pretty nasty job here. But there's one thing that could be considered a redeeming quality in here for the editors. Can anybody discern what that is? So anybody here when we talked about... If you were here when we talked about Saul's to get him confused. Second rejection. When he went to war against the Amalekites, what was his problem?
He didn't kill the king.
He brought the cattle back and he didn't kill the king. He left some at least one person alive and the cattle. Now when David goes to fight the Amalekites, what does he do? As was his practice, he wiped everyone out. The first list of people here, the Geshurites, the Gerzites, the Amalekites, these are people that the Israelites met on the way in from Egypt, and they were supposed to wipe them out completely, and they didn't, and they continued to be a problem at least until David got there. In some cases, the text indicates that some of them are still around. But David now has wiped them out according to the story. And the editors, I think, are leaving a subtle argument here for us that David is able to do now what Saul failed to do, maintaining the favor of God. That is abhorrent to most of us, that warfare should be fought this way, that everyone should be annihilated, that basically genocide should be practiced. But it's part of our tradition. Yes?
The second list, is did he actually wipe the people out of the Kenites and...
I think we have to understand he went into great small villages, not whole clans. But so you've got you're on the Negev is the southern section. Right on the Negev is also translated as desert in Hebrew, and so he's on the edge of civilization. These are the people who are part of a clan that reaches down to the edge of civilization. And he's hitting on these small border outposts, little farms, family farms, and so on. Not the whole clan. So the Kenites aren't being eliminated here, but a family or a couple of families from the clan.
And they're not associated with either the Israelites or the Philistines?
They're Judahites. They're part of Judah. Okay. Which, according to most people, Bethlehem is as well. These are theoretically his own relatives. And that's why at the end of the chapter, Achish is saying, he's in my back pocket. You know, if the Judahites know that he's been attacking other Judahites, there's no way they're going to accept him back. He is, as the title for today says, a flat-out mercenary. I need a place to stay. I need resources for my army. And I'm going to get them any way I can. This is a paycheck. So this is our ideal king. I'll remind you again that when the Book of Kings evaluates every king of Israel and every king of Judah, the signs, the standards by which they are evaluated are Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who was the worst of the worst kings from Israel, the first king of Israel, and David, son of Jesse, the best of the best kings. And only Hezekiah and Josiah get rated anything like David. And almost everybody else is lacking compared to him. I'll remind you, most of us were at Matins this morning, Psalm 27. The Lord is my salvation, whom shall I fear? Salvation could very well be a martial term. Victory is often the translation of that word that stands behind our translation of salvation. But this is the kind of situation that David mentioned. Consistent warfare for his early adult years, and frightening situation after frightening situation. And it makes it completely believable that Psalm 27 could have been one of his. It's listed as one of his. This is the guy. This is the guy who wrote that wonderful poetry. Other questions or comments? So, in chapter 27, we got David's fear, which we've talked about, that he's going to be killed by Saul, even though he just received a blessing from him, which is one of those quirky things about the way the text gets put together by the people who told us the story. Saul blesses him, and then his immediate response is, I'm afraid. Maybe he's more aware of, sees more of Saul's madness than I can see through the text. That looked like reconciliation to me, but David didn't receive it that way. David's predicament in Achish's trap is that he's out here forced to fight against his own people to maintain his army, which of course doesn't happen at all today. And Achish understands that he's abhorrent. He's the word there is stinky. You know, it's like a smelly, vile thing to his own people.
My translation uses odious.
Odious. I kept grabbing my nose, but I couldn't. That was exactly the word I was
thinking. Sounds like.
Yeah. A couple of interesting things will come up here if we move into chapter 28, and if we get as far as 29 today. Beginning of 28, I take great comfort in this. I've only been fired once in my life so far. But David gets fired in chapter 29. And I think David gets fired and becomes the king of Israel, the ideal king of Israel. For anybody who's ever been fired, there's hope. I guess Richard Nixon could say the same. In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. Achish said to David, you know, of course, that you and your men are to go out with me in the army. David said to Achish, very well, then you shall know what your servant can do. Achish said to David, very well, I will make you today, and will make you my bodyguard for life. Okay? So there's another step. You know, talk about this. He becomes the Secret Service. Well, is that right?
Yeah.
The Clint Eastwood Achish of the Philistines. He's in the inner circle of at least one of the kings of the Pentapolis, or the leaders of the Pentapolis.
Are they talking about personal bodyguard or his army, the bodyguard of the Philistines as a whole?
What this usually means is that the king has a select force that's responsible directly to the king. We'll see David has a bodyguard, or sometimes it's called his personal contingent. And in the Three Musketeers, we see this sort of thing. There's the queen's army, the king's army, and the bishop's army. Everybody has and when things are going well, they all fight together against the enemy, and then when there's nobody else out there to fight, then they fight among themselves. David steps into the king's inner circle here. Now, this ends the episode with David and David's movement into full-blown treason, if you will. And then the story picks up with Saul again. Now Samuel died, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. Does this strike anyone as odd who's been here all week?
Samuel died
died 3 chapters ago. 25:1. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned him. Well, it's not contradicting him. They buried him at his home in Ramah. And then David got up and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now David, this may be, okay, we've followed David for a couple chapters, and we're going back to that same point. Sometimes the narrative works that way.
Is this used maybe as a way of marking points of time?
Yeah. Okay. So that this section of David going to the Philistines is an aside or a background piece. We step out of the time there, and then we step back to where we left off.
Sort of like saying, we're about at the time when Samuel died.
Yeah, or meanwhile back at the ranch.
But David had joined the Philistines before Samuel died.
No, I think he Samuel died and he ran off. And then we get the story about the Philistines. And then we pick up the story again with Saul. Here we're going to see something that's never happened since. That is, a king or a leader makes a law and then decides to violate it. Saul had expelled the mediums and the wizards from the land. This stuff is bad news. We've heard about it in Deuteronomy and Leviticus. Most people say that that's later material, and this is evidence that even early in Israelites' tradition, when they still had the possibility about talking of other gods, they put necromancers and wizards. That was never part of the official religion of Israel. The Philistines assembled and came and encamped at Shunem. Saul gathered all Israel there, and they encamped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, not by dreams, not by Urim, or by prophets. It's casting kind of sticks, the Urim, which is exactly what you would do in the ancient Near East. We would do a computer analysis of forces and so on. They had dreams and prophets and cast their lots. Then Saul said to his servant, "Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, so that I may hear her, go to her and inquire of her." His servant said to him, "There is a medium at Endor," which shows how successful his edict had been. Even the men close to the king knew exactly where to go to find the medium. Saul, knowing that he's in the wrong, disguises himself and put on other clothes and went there, and he and the two men with him. They came to the woman by night and said, "Consult a spirit for me and bring up for me one whom I name to you." The woman said to him, "Surely you know that Saul has done." Perfect answer. So that because no question that we know that he knows he's in the wrong to be doing this. And it's sort of like the classic picture in the movies when we see undercover cops dealing with prostitutes, and they have to say, "I'm a policeman," before they can make a deal, which I've never understood. She says, "You know this is illegal, I can't do this." And he says, why are you about to tell me that Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing." And then the woman says, "Whom shall I bring up?" And he says, "Bring up Samuel." When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul," so she knows what's up. "I'm busted. Have no fear. What do you see?" The woman said to Saul, "I see a divine being coming up out of the ground." And he said to her, "What is his appearance?" "An old man is coming up. He's wrapped in a robe." So Saul knew that it was Samuel. And we talked about Samuel being very distinctively looking because he's a Nazarite, supposedly never had his hair cut, and had dressed differently. And he bowed with his face to the ground and did obeisance. Again, this you're about to ask for a favor, you get yourself in a very, contrary to the American power position of demanding something. Here in Israel, the ancient world, you got down on your face and made yourself a servant, even if you were in a superior position or in a strong position. And I love Samuel's response here. It's almost like he's yawning and saying, "Oh God, I'm sleeping so well. Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams." He left something out here, didn't he? Yeah, I think maybe that's sort of shady at this point. Maybe Samuel would. He thought Samuel would not approve. But these other two are legitimate means of seeking counsel from God. "All right, so I've summoned you to tell me what I should do." Samuel said, "Why do you ask me? Since the Lord has turned away from you and become your enemy, the Lord has done to you just as he spoke by me." So poor Saul, the guy for about 17 chapters now can't get a break. He repents, he prays, he sacrifices, and always the answer comes back the same: "You're rejected, you're rejected, you're rejected." And this time it even comes from beyond the grave. He goes and he consults a medium, and Samuel comes back from the dead, says, "Why did you wake me? Why did you disturb me?" Just as I told you before, and it's the same thing today, you were on the picture that passed it from your hand and handed over to David. Which to me is a shocking thing, seeing what we've just seen David doing. But again, God works in ways different from what we can understand. In verse 20, Saul fell immediately full length on the ground, filled with fear because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had not even hit, for he had done nothing all day and all night. Apparently he'd been fasting in preparation for his consultation. And the woman came to Saul. When he saw that he was terrified, she said to him, "Your servant has listened to you. I have taken my life in my hand, and I have listened to what you have said to me. Now therefore, I also listen to your servant. Let me set a morsel of bread before you, eat that you may have strength when you go on your way." He refused and said, "I will not eat," but it sounds like classic depression here. But his servants together with the women urged him, and he listened to their words. And so he got up and he sent him on his way. Again, as some of you have heard this before, it's striking to me how intent this text is on putting Saul in a negative light. In almost every opportunity, to make the claim that Saul is rejected by God, the text takes it. And no matter what he has done, I mean, he's just trying to save lives here. You know, why go up against an army if you can't win? Get a word from God. Go to the last person you knew spoke the word of God, clearly. And the text, interestingly enough, the text doesn't tell us that this is impossible. Samuel comes back from the dead to prophesy one more time. It's like Friday the 13th, part 37. As far as Saul is concerned, another bad word comes to him from God through the mouth of Samuel. Questions or comments? Rebuttals? Yes?
Just the fact that they put this after telling what David has done really emphasizes that too. Because, you know, it's kind of like when you're solving things himself, well, after what David's done and what they've said to me in the past isn't true, it can't be David. And it's just like the text makes sure you realize that even though David is being a traitor right now, he's still better than Saul.
Mm-hmm. Which hunts, you know, stirs up for me the ambiguity of judging anyone else's actions. And we have laws, we have traditions, we have customs, we have theology. But the Hebrew text reminds me again and again, especially with David. I can't judge anybody else's actions. That's entirely up to God.
Does Saul know where David is and what's going on?
At this point, he knows that David's out of the country in what's a traitor situation. And there have been a couple of other situations that could legitimately be called treasonous that we've seen David involved in prior to this.
At this time, okay?
Yes.
Peter, it makes me feel like God's unfair, too. I mean, what you said, we can't judge anybody else's actions. In a way, it makes me feel, you know, angry or judgmental about God. Like, what? I mean, you said several times, you know, it's the same. I mean, Saul tries, and always the answer comes back no. And you just say, well, come on, what?
All I can say is yeah. and add that we also have a book of Ecclesiastes in the canon, which tells us we can't know what God wants even us to do. All we can do is, depending on where you are in the book, but the thing that rings out for me as sort of as core for the book of Ecclesiastes is follow your heart's desire and know in the end you will answer to God. What we do, we set up laws, we set up expectations, we set up theologies, and they make the culture run better, and they make the churches run better, but they don't necessarily tell us what God wants. They tell us what makes cultures run better. what makes societies run better, what makes institutions run better. For example, those of us who are here as Lutherans, Martin Luther was a heretic. You know, we know better today because we know the strength of the Lutheran Church and what it contributes to the world. But in 1540 before he died, Martin Luther was a heretic to the church. And those goofy Saxons were just hellraisers. Rome was the seat of authority for the church. They knew what God wanted because they were the church. Luther was a wild man who, if he had been caught after the Diet of Worms, would have been executed.
Well, he said horrible things about the Jews.
Oh, yeah.
Horrible.
And that's, yeah, that's to remind us that Luther spoke particular things that were true and particular things that were absolutely useless. Worse than useless. And we respect Luther for the work that he did that gave us, I think, this fine tradition, but we also realize that he had his own problems and was unique. In the same way that no one, I don't think, well, some people do, actually, but I'm certainly not going to suggest that David's way of fighting warfare is the way that we should fight it. David made contributions to literature, according to the tradition, certainly was beneficial to the nation of Israel and their preservation, but he's not the model husband. He's not the model father. Like Luther, he was human and had his problems and made some big, big mistakes that we don't want to follow. Yeah.
The other thing that this sort of makes me think about is how easily we get into ranking people's sins, the certain sins worse than others.
Mm-hmm.
And that God's view may be looking at what he can do with each of us with all our faults. And Saul may not be rejected because he's more evil than David, but because his gifts at that time were not what Israel needed in a king.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think, it kind of reminds me of that story about President Carter when he talks about that he had lust in his heart and that was every bit as bad in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God's view in some ways is that we've all fallen short, whether, but we always, I think we always rebel against that and want to start making a hierarchy of sins.
Well, those of us who are good certainly do.
Yeah. But the ones who are, you know, that they're more, I think that's one of the issues that comes in the issue of homosexuality, you know. Somehow the sin, if people say homosexuality is a sin, then somehow that sin is much worse than any sin they're willing to acknowledge themselves.
You know?
Or anything that you make hierarchy of, that if you somehow define it first as a sin, then if it's not your sin, it's worse.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. If it's not mine, it's a real sin. There's a joke, I've done a lot of work in Christian Jewish relations, and one of the jokes is the only thing that two Jews can agree on is how much a third should give to charity. the only thing two Christians can agree on is that their sin is not as bad as somebody else's and how someone else should act. I think the thing to remember as this story unfolds, and when I talk about the story and the collection of stories that make up the Hebrew Bible, is we are all part of humanity, and the nation of Israel comes not by anything that Abraham and Sarah have done, but totally as an act of grace. There's absolutely no reason that you can find that Abraham and Sarah are chosen and not, Daniel and Anat, you know, to pick two names that were probably in use in the Canaanite world because of the deities, the name for deities over there. There's no reason that there weren't two people from Ugarit or two, a man and a woman from the Canaanites that were chosen. They weren't abhorrent because of what they were doing at the time. They were abhorrent because they weren't Israel. And the only reason Israel was because God was gracious. And each of us, you know, being human means, according to this, collection, that you're going to be different from God and therefore sinful and in need of grace. Maybe, I sometimes think that the reason that David is the ideal king is that he makes that so clear to us. That no one, I can't think of anyone in the Bible in greater need of grace than David. He's a bloodthirsty warrior. He's uncontrollable with it. Literally watches his son, not quite literally, stands by after one son has raped one of his daughters, stands by and doesn't do anything until another son murders that son, and he just goes and seduces the wife of one of his bodyguard, and when she gets pregnant, sends him off to be murdered in battle. And, David keeps saying to me, "You're not so bad. There's probably enough grace to go around for you, too."
He's the kind of guy that I was talking about last night.
Well, in some ways, as Roland was talking, I was wondering, maybe that's the reason. If men collected these stories, which we're almost certain that they did, maybe that's why David comes out as the ideal. Maybe he is the primary, represents the primary male fantasy. Sleeping with lots of attractive, wealthy women, and still somehow maintaining his freedom as it's perceived. Was there a question?
No, I'm checking my sleeve.
I do want to get to a couple other pieces here. We already talked about them, but marking the time with Samuel died. There's another piece of framing here that we see at, it was right there, beginning of 29. If someone would read 29, if someone wouldn't mind reading the whole chapter, actually, it's only 11 chapters.
Now the Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the fountain, which is in Jezreel. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is not this David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years, and since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day?" But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back, that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David, of whom they sing to one another in dances? Saul was slain has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000. Then Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been honest, and to me it seems right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign. For I have found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, the lords do not approve of you. So go back now and go peaceably, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." And David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day that I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord and king?" And Achish made answer to David, "I know that you are blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He shall not go up with us to the battle.' Now then, rise early in the morning with the servants of your lord who came with you, and start early in the morning and depart as soon as you have light." So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. But the Philistines went up to Jezreel.
Thank you. So, there it is. If you've ever been sacked, don't be ashamed. If you ever get sacked, there's a future in front of you. You might end up being the king of Israel, or queen. It happened to David.
But is David upset about this?
Oh yeah. He's protesting here for the opportunity to be a part of the battle.
I mean, it's genuine. It's not for show.
I think this is genuine. What's gone here, and the way it's presented. I mean, this is shaming. for David, I think.
He doesn't feel off the hook about having to go into...
Well, we don't know that for sure. I read it as he's being shamed by the Philistines. It may be that the tellers of the story are letting him off the hook. You know, these little border raids are one thing, but now we're going out to a real battle at Jezreel, you know, launched from Jezreel. And if David had participated in that, and this is the battle in which Saul is going to be killed, so David would really be in a bind if he were portrayed as a usurper who was involved in the battle in which the anointed of Israel had been murdered. Actually, he kills himself to avoid being killed by the uncircumcised Philistines. But if David had been involved in that, it would have been a real problem. This seemed to be a genuine protest to me. What have I done? And it's interesting, an effect that David has had on Achish, this uncircumcised Philistine, is that the language that he uses, when he takes an oath to David, as the Lord lives, he takes this oath by the name of David's God. Mm-hmm. And you are as blameless as an angel of God, and he uses the Hebrew word for God rather than, you know, maybe, you know, then these guys are supposed to be speaking another language. The language of the Philistines has never been really deciphered, because there's only a little bit of it in existence. But in the text, there's this sort of implicit witness to Yahweh and then to Elohim, the two basic names for God in the Hebrew Bible, coming out of the mouth of this Philistine, which is an effect that the good guys in the Bible always seem to have when they're among foreigners. Happens with Joseph, happens with Daniel, and here it happens with David among the Philistines. Note in verse 5, this piece that comes up in chapter 18, verse 7, after David comes back from killing Goliath, and there's this wonderful song, and Saul comes first, but David has the position of prestige. Even these Philistines know about this hymn, this battle hymn. And they know who David is, and they're not about to have him in their midst with him as they go up to fight the Israelites. And I mentioned the other day that Arab Israelis, Arab citizens of Israel, in part because of this, are exempted from military service, or are precluded from military service that might put them in conflict, might actually put them in a position to pull the trigger against another Arab. And it's this kind of same ambivalence. One, we don't quite trust them. Two, we don't want to put them in that odious position, which Ron will tell you puts Arab Israelis in a very disadvantaged position when they try to get jobs and so on, since everything is really based on your military service. But it comes out of, I think, a part of this tradition. Did you have a question or a comment?
Apparently now there's, in the Arab world, there's a great deal of resentment that the king of Saudi Arabia had let American Jewish people on the soil where the holy places were. And it was bad enough to let foreign troops there, but to let Jewish troops there. And that's undermining his authority there.
Mm-hmm. And undermining ours as well, because we made some big concessions to our principles to be able to be there and rescue them. It was a strange one. Strange situation. So there's a quick picture of David the mercenary, just about out of time is where I was from. David comes back and finds that Ziklag has been sacked by the Amalekites, whom we thought had been eliminated. And David goes and fights them and finishes that off and rescues his family. And by the end of chapter 31, Saul is dead, and then we move into David's preparation to merge two kingdoms. David becomes king of the south, and it takes him about 7 years before he's able to cut a deal with Abner, Saul's chief military officer, who's been running things with other family members in the north out of Benjamin. After 7 years, he moves to Jerusalem and unites the two kingdoms. And then for a few chapters, things go well for David. And then he starts casting his eyes about on other men's wives, and it gets interesting again.
Peter, is there any sense, I don't know if it's, if there's a brief answer to it, is there any sense of David being preserved by this traitorous act to fight again, to be the king? In other words, if he had been with Saul, and the same fate had befallen that whole army, then the heir apparent would be dead too. I mean, is there?
Well, yeah, because David and Jonathan, Saul and Jonathan died on the same day.
Right.
And David, if David had been there, he may well have. Right. The battle might have gone a different way, or yeah. It did, but.
But there's no interpretation of it in the text that says that David is there preserved to fight again.
Well, I think it's implicit in the story.
I see.
I mean, in the whole story, he's preserved. What he's preserved clearly from is Saul.
Right.
I mean, he may not have got to that day in chapter 31 when Saul and Jonathan died, because every once in a while, Saul just turns around and flings a spear at him. how lucky can you get? I mean, we've already seen him escape twice, and David has spared him twice.
Right.
Or David might have committed the ultimate sin, which is to raise one's hand against the anointed of the Lord, and therefore eliminated himself from. So David's speech at the beginning of 27, David's fear and removing himself from the presence of Saul seems to be part of the setup to get him out of danger. And like the end of 29, the middle of 29, where he is removed from this particular battle, the story seems to move along to keep him at a safe political / theological distance from the real trouble, so that he can step back in as a fairly unsullied person by these standards. Mm-hmm. I've had a great time these 2 weeks. Thanks for those of you who've been able to make it, and for the things you've taught me. Now I might be able to write this Bible study for the United Methodist with some confidence that people will understand what I'm saying. So, enjoy the rest of your time here.
Thank you.